Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, I'm not recommending for every future president that they take a shellacking like I did last night. You know, I'm sure there are easier ways to learn these lessons. But I do think that this is a growth process and an evolution.
The shellacking of the president, 2010, is over. Welcome back to A Divided America, folks. What does it mean? Here are some stats. 40 was the magic number in the exit polls. 40% of voters said they support the Tea Party movement. 40% said the deficit is the number one issue. 40% said job creation should be the government's top priority, way more than any other issue. A slightly closer look, however, reveals that the health care law divided the electorate. It didn't unify voters against the Democrats. 48% in the exit polls say repeal the law, but 47% said keep it or strengthen it. Similarly, 39% said cutting the deficit should be the top priority, but 37% preferred spending to create jobs. In the 2006 midterms for the House, when the Democrats first took over 4 years ago, the Democrats got 52% of all votes cast nationwide, the Republicans 45%. This week, it was exactly reversed, 52-45, but for the Republicans. In our very divided nation, this is what passes for a shellacking, to use the president's word, 52-45. We'll do more stats as we go along here this morning, but let's begin today with the return of the road trippers, three political reporters who went out around the country during the campaign. They came on together a couple of weeks ago, you may remember, and they are back. Farai Shadeya, whose Pop and Politics specials on WNYC conclude with a post-election show tonight at 8. WNYC's Andrea Bernstein from our Transportation Nation project, and Joe Klein, political columnist for Time Magazine, who calculates he put 6,000 miles on his jalopy going from state to state this fall. And Joe, knowing you, I would guess it's some kind of pretty nice jalopy.
Well, I rented an SUV, a giant Ford Flex, which sounded kind of aerobic, but looked like a refrigerator. it was nearly 7,000 miles,
You rented an SUV to feel like a real American getting off the coast?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what? As a result of this trip, I think that my current car is a Toyota. My next car is going to be an American car, but a hybrid.
Andrea, how about the four-year sweep from 52-45 for Democrats to 52-45 total Americans voting for, you know, one party or the other for Republicans in House races? What does it mean?
Well, I think it means, I mean, you know, it's easy to look at those numbers as being pretty small. They seem small. They seem separated by, 7 points? But they're big. And the reason that they're big is, you know, I mean, let's sort of just think about 2008 and what a sweep it was for Obama. And, you know, these states that had not voted for a Democrat since the 1960s, Indiana and North Carolina, and it just, the country seemed to be moving in a direction, and now it has, you know, just continue the car metaphor, radically shift into reverse and pretty fast, I think at a much more breathtaking speed than any of us would have imagined. And, you know, one of the things that I think has happened here is that it's not just that people don't understand Obama's policies or that he didn't explain them. It's that things have objectively gotten worse. And in February of 2009, when the stimulus bill passed, unemployment was at 8%. It's now at double digits in a lot of these key swing states, and it just seems to be hanging there no matter what they do. Healthcare reform. There's a promise of universal health care, but in the meantime, people's costs have gone up. So there's a lot that the Obama administration has done to try to address problems, but it hasn't hit people at home and, you know, at their kitchen tables, to continue the popular political metaphor.
But let me drill down.
Brian,
Go ahead, Joe.
That Bill Galston has a very elegant analysis of this today in the New Republic. The exact same numbers of Republicans and Democrats and independents voted this time as voted last time, which, you know, kind of belies the whole Republican enthusiasm gap. What happened was that independents switched. You know, they went 6 points more toward Democrats in 2006 and 2008, and 6 points more toward Republicans this time. And, you know, this is while the political pendulum seems to become a metronome, you know, moving back and forth, clicking out heroes and bums every 2 years, it really is a change that's happened in the middle of the spectrum.
But I also wonder how much, even in the middle of the spectrum, those are the same voters changing their minds. I read that Bill Galston article, and I recommend it as well. Galston from the Brookings Institution, doing some very good number crunching on the New Republic site. But taking from that and some other sources, an election is not the same 100 people in the room every year, and, you know, they all deliberate and change their minds or not. It's a big rolling puzzle of who votes, with very few ever changing their minds, though some independents clearly did this year. So this year, from what I read, including on the Galston piece, youth turnout went down from 18% to 11% of the electorate compared to 08. Black turnout from 13 to 10%, while senior citizens who vote 60% Republican went up from 19% in 2006 to 23% of the electorate. So it's not 100 reasonable people doing a deliberative democracy experiment. It's who's turned on, who's turned off, who's mad as hell to pick up an electoral baseball bat, and all of that, Joe, yes?
Yeah, I think, and also, you know, the percentage of people who voted this time, much lower than last time as well. I mean, you know, I don't know what the exact figures were, but I doubt if it was up in the 60s as it was in the presidential election.
No, it was 42% of registered voters is what I saw.
And so when you get cuts, you know, what happens is that the elderly are kind of chronic voters. They're going to vote no matter what. And so as a result, their percentage goes up. And groups like young people and some of the minorities, although African-Americans are chronic voters as well, especially when compared to Latinos.
Farai, you've been looking at some of these numbers, some of these turnout numbers. What are you seeing?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the things that I saw yesterday on one of the cable crawls was low minority turnout. I think that's unfair, because the reality is that this was the last election was, you know, basically every black person who could make it in a walker, a wheelchair, you know, anything but a stroller would go to the polls to vote for Obama, including a bunch of Republicans. Like, people are also saying, well, 14% of black men voted Republican in this election. Isn't that high? Well, it's not that high. Black men actually have a small cohort of stable Republican voters. Last time, though, a lot of black Republican men voted for President Obama for sort of historical precedent-setting reasons and thought it would be good for black Republicans as well as for black Democrats. So the last election was an anomaly. And in many ways, this is kind of bringing us back to where the American electorate goes in midterms, both in terms of proportions of voters and voting patterns. What I found interesting, I do think that there's a lot to be said about the independent voter swinging. Generationally, the only group to go for Democrats was the under 30 crowd. And of course, they did turn out in a, you know, relatively low but not unprecedented percentage. But I think part of the issue here is a structural issue. There is no place for independents to go that really represents their interest. What we call independents include third party members, people who are declined to state, people who are true swing voters. It's a very heterogeneous group. The two-party system does not speak to their interest. We do not have a sufficient system for funneling political dissent and alternate viewpoints into the election, so we shouldn't be surprised there's this volatile group.
And we'll talk more in our next segment, funnily enough, where we're going to do a Palin versus Bloomberg scorecard and see how one person with possible presidential aspirations in one corner of politics did compared to Michael Bloomberg, who may try to, you know, capitalize on exactly what you were just describing in 2012, we will see. But Farai, one other thing from what you said, that generational divide, and I know you'll be reporting on this in the Pop and Politics special tonight. Again, back to those stats. As young people turned out less than 2008, older people, 65 plus, compared to the last midterm elections in 2006, their share of the electorate went up from 19% to 23%, and they vote 60% Republican. And they don't like the health reform bill because they actually think it's going to give them less Medicare. They voted against the Democrats because they want more government health care, not less, if you can unpack all of that. But what do you make of the generational divide?
Well, I think that, you know, there's no question that many voters do become more conservative over time. It's not just at this moment in time, but sort of over people's life cycles. Not all, but some people do become more conservative. And there is, you know, when we went for the Pop and Politics Project to a retirement community, 20,000 people in Florida, they have a huge amount of time to sit around and parse the issues really far down. I mean, it's like young people, not only do they have less historical knowledge about politics, but also they don't have, you know, they're presumably either in school or working, although many are not either right now. But there's not necessarily a community, like a fun day at Sun City is to sit around and debate politics for 4 hours straight with some muffins and coffee. That is not a typical fun day for a 19-year-old.
Well, right. Also, you can vote right there. I mean, in a lot of cases in retirement communities, it's very, very easy to vote. You don't have to go anywhere. And one of the things that, you know, sort of thinking about this 100 people in a room metaphor is that I spent a lot of time in swing counties where people really do go back and forth. You know, the counties that voted, they just vote, you know, they voted for Bush and then they voted for Obama and they voted for Bill Clinton. And this year they voted overwhelmingly Republican. And there were a lot of individual voters who I met who said, you know, I thought things would get better and I am very, very unsure about the Democrats' ideas too. I hate them. And, you know, for some of the groups that didn't come out to vote, I mean, wasn't the sort of motivating force of history. But at the same time, I mean, I met a voter in Tampa, Florida, who was a member of the middle class. He had worked for 40 years as a welder, African-American man, and who in the last 2 years lost his job, can't find work anywhere in the state of Florida. And he described to me just going everywhere. There was this constant building boom. It screeches to a stop. In the last 2 years, he loses his home, he loses his car, he loses everything. And, you know, these are not people who are necessarily going to turn out to the polls. There are a lot of problems in those lives. Young people, same thing. I mean, people are worried about getting jobs. They're struggling. So many young people said, I'm just too busy to vote. So there's, you know, that's an economic
hour, at the end of next hour, we're going to do a call-in specifically for that nearly 60% of Americans who did not vote on Tuesday. And we'll see why. Joe, go ahead.
There's an absolutely huge and unique phenomenon here that's staring us in the face. It's unique to this year, and it's this. The Democrats were tossed out not because they failed, but because they succeeded. They managed to pass the Democratic fantasy list, starting with health care reform, of the last 60 years. And then, in one of the great mysteries of the 40 years that I've been covering politics, they pass all this stuff that they always wanted, and then they refuse to sell it. In fact, they run away from it.
Yeah, but Joe,
it is one of the right. most remarkable things I've ever seen, and right. one of the most cowardly.
They passed it, but it hasn't gone into effect for most people.
But
the provisions
haven't explained it.
About
senior citizens, and the impression that senior citizens have about health care reform is wrong. They think their Medicare is going to be cut, and each of them just got $250 in the mail to fill the donut hole. But the president didn't see fit to even announce that.
And some of the Democrats ran against it. You know, I mean, it's really honestly the Democrats don't have a common playbook. They just don't.
Here are some of the independent stats, by the way. Just so we drill down on this a little bit more, and my guests are Andrea Bernstein, Farai Shadeya, Joe Klein, who all went out covering voters around the country this year before these elections. The independents, in both 2006 and this year, according to the William Galston from Brookings Institution number crunching, in both 2006 and this year, 28% of voters identified themselves to exit pollsters as independents. But in 2006, 57% of those independents voted for Democrats when they took the House. This week, just 39%. Joe, that's about as huge a swing in politics as we see in this country, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, and I think it's mostly because, you know, the Democrats didn't explain what they did, and they weren't focused enough on the important stuff. I mean, a lot of the blue dogs, the blue dogs really got lacerated. I mean, their caucus has, you know, which was 54 before, lost, I think, at least 28 seats. And the fact is that the positions that they took to produce a smaller stimulus package and a less powerful financial regulatory reform that didn't bust up the big banks, I think in the end led to the public sense that nothing, that the government wasn't doing very much of anything except maybe helping poor people.
So, Farai, this Tea Party bloc that's coming in, and the 40% of voters who said they support the Tea Party movement, do you think there's going to be a Tea Party caucus in the House of Representatives? Do you think we're going to see this movement evolve now? Will 40% of the electorate in 2012, 2014 say they are Tea Partiers, whatever that means for them?
Well, Boehner's first job is going to be to hug the Tea Party so hard that they hurt. We love you, crunch, 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 crunch. You know, I mean, there's going to be this embrace of the Tea Party movement that is really designed to neutralize. I don't know how well that's going to work.
I thought he made a little gaffe in his appearance yesterday morning, by the way, when he said something to the effect of, I think the Tea Partiers are going to work well with our party.
Yes.
As if to distinguish. He didn't mean to do it, but that's how it came out.
Yeah, it was a little truth in advertising. I mean, you know, mainline Republicans who have been around and been in office are not comfortable with the Tea Party movement. And, you know, we had a chance to catch up yesterday with the chair of a woman named Lisa Replegal, who's the chair of the Colorado River Tea Party group, which is a very influential group based out in Arizona. And she's like great guns for the Tea Party. And people had differences of opinion, people who we spoke to, about whether the Tea Party movement would continue to have legs as a standalone, because we've seen many groups and movements rise and fall. You know, Ralph Reed, for example, is back on television, but the Christian conservative movement as a whole certainly doesn't have the power that it did in the past. And so movements rise and fall within, you know, sort of ideological sectors.
So do you think, Andrea, that politically speaking, it will be in the interest of both parties to find small bore areas of common ground, or to dig in on posturing to get their bases all fired up to try to win a governing majority in 2012? You know, the president in his news conference yesterday mentioned a few relatively small things, a moratorium on earmarks, repealing a small but onerous part of health reform that requires small businesses to file a lot more 1099 tax forms, some alternative energy programs, but not cap and trade. Is it meaningful and is it realistic?
You know, it's hard for me to see how they get there. And one of the most interesting interviews I had was out in Ohio with the now Congressman-elect Jim Renacci, who won in a district against John Boccieri. This was a Ohio 16, sort of Northeast Ohio Rust Belt. Obama was paying particular attention to it. And I said to Jim Renacci two things. The first thing I said was, what are you going to do after this election is done? And everybody's been hearing, everybody in government's a thief, a crook, stealing this, that, and the other thing from me, running off with jobs. How are you going to govern? And it's a question that went largely unanswered. And I don't think either the Republicans or the Democrats are figuring out. I mean, one of the things we haven't talked about, but, you know, out in the heartland, and Joe, I'm sure you saw this too, the ads were overwhelming, constantly telling people how bad people in government were. So there is a real hurdle and trust to bring, put back together.
Joe, very briefly, you were there in the 90s when President Clinton lost Congress, and he did retreat into small bore but doable progressive chunks along with some of the Gingrich Congress agenda. Do you think something like that is going to happen now?
Well, what happened was this. You know, the Republicans wouldn't play at first, and Clinton was a very big bore. He stood up to them and allowed them to shut down the government. We may see that happen again this time. But once the Republicans realized that doing nothing, shutting down the government, gridlock, wasn't what the public wanted, they began to cooperate in some areas of mutual interest, like welfare reform.
Right.
And, you know, it all depends on what the Republicans want here.
Farai Shadeha, Poppin' Politics, the last of your election specials.
Yeah, last of the election
tonight
specials.
Tonight at 8 o'clock.
Tonight at 8 on WNYC and on video on poppinpolitics.com, because we shot it as a live event in the green space, which is, you know, lots of fun. And, you know, we definitely wanted to hear from people who are not politicians. And that's what we went out to do, is to listen to people. I don't think people are as crazy or irrational as we think. But one of the real problems with politics today is that there's very little mechanism for people to act in between elections. So that's why you see the pendulum swing. People don't have a consistent relationship with their congresspeople or even their state reps. We make it very difficult in this country.
Our political road trippers, Farai Shadeya, Andrea Bernstein, Joe Klein, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll do that Palin versus Bloomberg endorsement scorecard next with authors who have written a book about each. Stay with us.